American media brags the U.S. will again become the world's largest exporter of what I call climate-wrecking fossil fuels. But the biggest American coal companies went bankrupt, and now the largest U.S. natural gas company lost billions while their stock became, well, junk. That clash of messages comes with reports that fracking companies are blasting large quantities of methane straight into the atmosphere instead of selling it as a product, as natural gas. To figure out what is going on, we have Nick Cunningham on the line with a master's in international relations and international economics from Johns Hopkins. Nick often publishes at oilprice.com and many other places. He's a widely published independent reporter on the oil and gas industry. From Portland, Oregon, Nick Cunningham, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Nick, let's start out with this. Can you please explain for our listeners where the Permian Basin is and its importance for fossil fuel production in the United States?
Yes, absolutely. So the Permian Basin is in West Texas and parts of southeastern New Mexico. That part of Texas has been an oil-producing region for a long time, a century or so, but it was thought to have been depleted long ago, and production went into decline sometime around the 70s. But after the onset of the fracking revolution with horizontal drilling, the Permian Basin has a new lease on life, and production there has soared, and it's now, in some metrics, the largest source of oil production in the world, certainly in the United States. So the story of fracking really kind of is concentrated there, among other places, but that's the biggest one.
Why are natural gas drillers flaring off or simply venting large quantities of methane into the air, Nick?
That's a good question. So when you drill for oil and gas, when you drill for oil, gas comes up along with it. And the Texas drillers are really after the oil. So when they go and they frack a well in West Texas, a lot of gas comes up with it, called associated gas. Now, they have the pipelines to move oil to the Texas coast, which is far away, but they don't have enough pipelines to move gas. And because of that, there's a localized glut of gas trapped in the desert in West Texas, and that causes prices to crash. And instead of slowing down on the drilling operations, they're trying to move as much oil as possible, in part because they're under a lot of financial pressure. Instead, they just burn the gas into the air. Now, they say that they're working on this problem, and this is a temporary issue due to infrastructure constraints, but it's an epidemic in terms of the climate, in terms of local air quality. So it's a big problem, and then the Texas regulators are asleep at the wheel. There's certain regulations on flaring. Companies are allowed to flare in the first few weeks or months of a well coming online. So there are some limits, but the Texas Railroad Commission, which is the regulator in the state, has never denied a flaring permit to a company. They've issued thousands of permits. They issued over 5,000, I think it was, last year. So you have 5,000 times a company goes to the regulator and says, can I flare? And they say, yeah, sure, go ahead. So there really isn't a cop on the beat.
In February 2018, there was a huge methane leak from a blown gas well in Ohio. The release was so large, methane was measured from space by the Dutch. And there was more methane, they say, from this single accident than from other entire countries. Nick, why can't the industry control that?
Well, you know, there's a certain amount of risk that comes with every drilling operation, and what we've learned over the years is that methane leaks at every stage of the drilling process. It leaks at the well, it leaks in the pipeline, it leaks at compressor stations, it leaks in storage tanks. And the argument from the industry has long been that gas is a really good thing for the climate because it's going to replace coal in power plants. And there's been a big debate about how much methane is released completely wipes out that argument. And there's a debate about what threshold of methane leaks wipes out that climate benefit. But the fact is, gas is still a fossil fuel, so even if it's slightly better than coal, it's still a huge fossil fuel. But what we are learning is that the methane is leaking at faster rates than we thought. And then with the example that you cited, there are accidents where this is, you know, there's massive amounts of methane that are released from one specific project. I actually interviewed a guy who lived near that well that you're talking about, and his family had all sorts of health issues, skin rashes and respiratory problems. So there's dangers from living near the sites. It's not just a climate problem, but a local health and environmental problem.
But we do have fracking rigs right beside schools and churches and suburbs. I've seen photographs of it. It's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's in places like Colorado where the drilling is really bumping up against residential areas, that's when you get a lot more conflict. Also true in Pennsylvania and Ohio. Texas is that's the case too, but, you know, there's a lot more space too. And there's places where there's drilling where there aren't a lot of people around. But, yeah, in Colorado, there's a big fight over the distance between a well and a residential area. And the industry poured in a ton of money to defeat a ballot measure. I guess it was late 2018. So, yeah, that's a big issue.
Tell us about the recent bankruptcies or stock crashes in the American gas industry, Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been more than 200 bankruptcies in the oil and gas sector in North America since 2015, which really highlights the issue of frack, which is that it's an unproven business model. Some of your listeners may know that a shale well, after initial burst of production, declines really quickly. It can lose something like 70 to 90% of its initial production within the first 3 years. So you get most of your oil and gas in that first year or two. That's very different from the conventional well or an offshore project, which once it goes online can produce pretty stably for a long time, for decades in some cases. So you've got steep decline rates from these shale wells, which means that you have to keep drilling, which means that you need money to drill the next well. The shale boom over the past decade was built largely on debt, companies borrowing money, and this is also made possible because since the financial crisis a decade ago, the global financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has kept interest rates near zero. So that means you can borrow, drillers could borrow loans at really low interest rates. And there's a lot of analysts that would say if not for that, the fracking boom never would have really taken off because it's largely built on debt. And for years, investors, Wall Street, was happy to kind of finance this thing because they expected that profits would soon be around the corner and, you know, companies would go back to Wall Street and kind of tap them again for another round of financing. Really, in the past year and a half, that narrative has kind of fallen apart, and Wall Street has gotten really sick and tired of not making any money from these drilling operations. And if you look at any of the share prices for the oil and gas companies in the U.S., since like the late 2018, the share prices have completely collapsed. And that's a reflection of the lost confidence from Wall Street. So Wall Street and the oil and gas sector have a kind of a symbiotic relationship. And the whole fracking frenzy is only really possible because of the constant reinjection of capital. So once Wall Street kind of closes off the spigot, then there's a big problem. And we're starting to see that at this point.
Tell us about the obscure Pittsburgh-based company called EQT. I'd never heard of it until I read your column.
Yeah, so EQT is actually the largest natural gas producer in the United States, and it's not a household name by any means, but it is, when you talk about shale gas drilling, EQT is kind of the giant in that space. You know, you have oil majors like Exxon and Chevron, they produce a lot of gas, but in terms of a pure shale gas company, EQT is the top name. And they bought a company called Rice Energy 2 or 3 years ago, which kind of put them in kind of the top spot in terms of gas production. And so they're based in Pittsburgh and western Pennsylvania, and this is the home of the Marcellus Shale. And so they really kind of symbolize the situation in Appalachia and the Marcellus Shale and kind of the shale gas frenzy. So there's, you know, you have Texas, but then the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania is a different thing. So EQT is the top dog there, and they're in big financial trouble too. They've been struggling for years. The company that they bought, Rice Energy, it was founded by a guy named Toby Rice, and he still owned some stakes in the company. He owned some stakes in EQT after he sold his company, and he kind of had, there's like a palace coup where he ousted EQT management last year because he said he could run the company better. So now he's the CEO, and he's running this company, and they just last week or a couple days ago said that they were taking a $1.8 billion write-down for the fourth quarter. So they're essentially saying their gas assets in western Pennsylvania are not worth as much as they thought they were. And Rice has been on record saying natural gas doesn't work with prices at $2.50 per MMBTU. Prices are below that right now. So he's essentially saying the whole prospect of fracking in western Pennsylvania is unviable at current prices. And so that's why they take this big write-down, and it's kind of a symbol of the huge financial struggles in the industry right now. And that comes after Chevron, late last year, took a $10 or $11 billion write-down. And they're basically giving up on the Marcellus Shale, and they said it couldn't work there either. So the Marcellus Shale is important because we have a decade, production has been rising for a decade, and that's why the U.S. is the top gas producer in the world, and that's why there's a huge petrochemical build-out in Appalachia and on the Gulf Coast. But we're starting to see that the finances of this whole venture are really questionable.
Yeah, Richard Heinberg wrote about this debt game in his book Snake Oil, and basically he was describing a kind of pyramid scheme.
Yeah. It's because of these steep decline rates in the wells. You have to constantly grow, you have to constantly drill, and all the money that comes out needs to be poured right back into the ground for the next well. And a lot of the oil executives like to say that they've figured this thing out, and it's a lot like manufacturing where you can kind of turn out widgets on a standardized basis. But that analogy only works if you assume you have to build a whole new factory each time. They have to drill a new well each time. Unlike conventional wells, once you drill the well, you produce for decades. These, you have to drill the wells over and over and over again just to keep production flat, let alone grow. So you need to be flying to New York to convince investors to continue to fund your operations, to keep pouring money in. And the whole notion was that they'd get costs down and then they'd eventually be profitable. But some companies are profitable, but in the aggregate, the industry has never been cash flow positive.
So if you're thinking about drilling in West Texas and you're really after the oil because you can still get some decent money for that, but the gas, you just don't have a pipeline to get rid of it yet. Now you're seeing more and more gas coming out of those wells compared to the valuable oil. I wonder, is that a sign of developing depletion of the fracking bonanza in West Texas?
Yeah, that's a great point. And the so-called gas-to-oil ratio has been rising. As you say, the oil is the lucrative part. The gas is not. And especially in Texas, where with the lack of pipelines, prices can fall as low as zero. And sometimes prices have even gone into negative territory, which means the producers have to pay somebody to take their gas away. So the gas is essentially worthless in West Texas. And the oil is really the only thing that they're after. But as these shale wells age and as the entire basin ages, the evidence is showing that a given well is starting to produce more gas relative to oil. So that it's getting gassier, if you will. Yeah, that's another kind of knock the whole financial prospect of the Permian Basin.
Nick Cunningham, what is happening with the price of oil from the Canadian tar sands, and how is that affecting the industry there? What have you heard about that?
Yeah, so the Western Canada Select, the WCS, is the price for heavy oil in Western Canada. And that price typically trades below prices in the U.S. by a couple of dollars per barrel, and that kind of reflects the fact that the quality, it's a heavier oil, it requires more processing. It also reflects the higher transportation costs for moving it across the North American continent. So that's always been the case, that it trades a few dollars per barrel below WTI, which is the price in Oklahoma and Texas. But when there's pipeline bottlenecks, that price starts to really trade at a huge discount, which is a reflection of it being kind of trapped in Alberta. So in late 2018, that price really collapsed. You had WTI U.S. prices in the 50s, and then WCS, the Canadian price, collapsed as low as $13, $14 a barrel.
Wow.
So essentially trading $40 per barrel below what oil sold for in the U.S. And that was because the oil sands operations had been adding new supply, but there wasn't any more pipelines to move it. And you got the Keystone XL pipeline, which has been bogged down for a decade. You got the Trans Mountain expansion, which has been bogged down for 5 or 6 years. A couple other projects have been canceled. There's a pipeline called Line 3 that is I think it's Enbridge is trying to replace it, which would add more capacity. That's been delayed too. And so you've got several pipelines that are completely stalled, and largely because of climate activists that have stalled these projects and indigenous groups. So you got fixed pipeline capacity and rising production in Alberta. And so that led to a glut and a crash in prices. In response, the provincial government in Alberta put in mandatory production cuts last year to kind of rescue this price, which had collapsed. And it worked. The prices, Alberta producers had to cut back, and prices rebounded. And then in the last year or so, incrementally, they've been kind of gradually lifting those cuts. However, recently, the price crashed once again. So it's kind of a reflection of Alberta, the government kind of easing off these cuts a little too fast. So the long and short of it is that Alberta's been struggling to move its oil out of the province, out of the country for a long time, and those problems haven't gone away.
Well, we can see that in the economy of Alberta, and here in British Columbia, we had a lot of people coming from Alberta and buying property. That seems to have dried up, and we have people from here going there, just commuting to Alberta to work, coming home on the weekends. That's pretty well wrapped up. So it's definitely problems for the oil industry there. What other countries are announcing their own fracking booms?
So North America is really the only game in town when it comes to fracking. China has been trying to figure this out for a long time, and they've had some success. And then Argentina is kind of the other one that looms large. They've got, I think it's the second largest shale gas reserves in the world and the fourth largest oil reserves. I actually just took a trip there a few months ago and was investigating their fracking industry there. They've got a lot more challenges, financial challenges, that probably stand in the way of them replicating what the U.S. and Canada have done. They've got macroeconomic instability, a fluctuating currency, inflation, export taxes, a lot of reasons why the oil majors are kind of reluctant to go all in on it. Not to mention that they don't have enough infrastructure. They don't have pipelines. They don't have compressor stations. All this stuff kind of needs to be built from scratch. And if U.S. companies are struggling with debt and are struggling to prove that fracking can be profitable, then Argentina is kind of much further away.
Can you tell us, as we wrap up here, about other stories that you're working on these days?
Yeah, so some research I just saw, I think it came out in the last few days, talked about the petrochemical build-out on the Gulf Coast. It's important to remember that all the oil and gas that's fracked in Texas or Pennsylvania, it goes somewhere, and the story doesn't end with just the fracking. So the oil is moved by pipeline, and it moves to the Gulf Coast, and there's this massive, massive build-out of petrochemical facilities to turn the gas into plastics, all sorts of chemicals. They need to build billion-dollar export facilities for both gas and oil. And so the Gulf Coast is kind of suffering under this huge, huge, huge wave of new facilities. And so some of the new research that just came out in the last few days estimates that the greenhouse gas emissions from this build-out could represent 10% of total U.S. emissions, which is to say it could rise by 10% because of this one sector in this one particular region. Now, that's kind of a high-end estimate because not all of these plants will be built, but it's illustrative of kind of the growth that comes after all of the fracking. And in fact, the emissions, this one report said, I forget where it was published, said that something like three-quarters of the increase in emissions is from the pipelines and all the downstream stuff, not fracking. So it's important for people to keep an eye on this because it flies beneath the radar. You know, nobody knows what ethane crackers are or other petrochemical facilities. Everybody talks about Exxon and Chevron, but the downstream is just as important and is less reported on by the media.
We have been speaking with freelance journalist and energy reporter Nick Cunningham. I check his work at oilprice.com every week because I find mind-blowing energy news not seen in other media. But Nick's stories appear all over the media. Please give your listeners your Twitter handle, Nick, so that they can get plugged in with you.
Yeah, it's Nick Cunningham and then the number one.
Nick Cunningham 1. Got it. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In our first interview, Dr. Mark Hudson thought Australia might decarbonize fairly quickly after the latest big fires. But he didn't think the country would stop exporting fossil fuels overseas. Australia is the world's biggest exporter of coal. The country recently overtook Qatar to become the world's largest exporter of natural gas. A new report from Bloomberg News shows that when we account for all the gas leaks from production through transportation and storage, liquid natural gas has a carbon footprint rivaling coal. The only hope to stop Australian exports of climate-killing fuels is for their overseas customers to stop buying. We need to get those sanctions in. We need climate activists from Australia and all countries to push solar and wind in Asia, including India. We have to stop the coal pits and gas pipes of Australia from further climate damage. There is a glimmer of hope. New data from the U.S. Energy Information Administration shows wind and solar will dominate new energy installations in America. In 2019, 76% of all new electricity generation comes from alternative green energy, while 85% of power plants closed were fired by coal and natural gas. It's going in the right direction there. The cost of wind and solar has fallen far below fossil fuels, even with government subsidies to the fossil fuel industry and no subsidies for solar or wind. The big news doesn't report that often, and we need to know that. Simple economics may drive out fossil fuels eventually, but will it happen in time? It's happening even in Arizona. The big Arizona Public Service Company just spent millions fighting off a clean energy ballot initiative. Now, they say, they want to be carbon-free by 2050 and coal-free by 2035. The Arizona utility promises to close its infamous Four Corners Generating Coal Plant in 2031. Trying for almost half renewables by 2030. Arizona is the Sunshine State, so why not be the Sunshine Powerhouse? By the way, hello to Radio EcoShock listeners in Bisbee, Arizona. In the United Kingdom, Prime Minister Boris Johnson just promised African leaders the UK would stop all direct support for coal mining and coal-fired power plants abroad. The UK pulled back from pushing coal projects, but still puts billions of pounds into helping oil and gas projects. So it's not like Johnson heard that there is a climate emergency for real. Maybe, as Kafka said, there is no hope for us, but there could be hope for the future. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and supporting this program. Radio EcoShock has broadcast for the last 14 years every week. It is now distributed free to 100 nonprofit radio stations in many countries. Thousands of people around the world download the program weekly. It is free of charge and advertising free from our website, ecoshock.org. Please tell others, in person and by social media. Many small streams can become a mighty river. It must. Let's do what we can together.